What comes to mind when you think of the word idol? That's I-D-O-L, idol. We may think of images or creatures made of wood, stone, statues of Buddha, an image or a physical object representing a deity and worshipped by human beings. We might even think of what used to be America's favorite television show, American Idol. American Idol. We are unabashed in the use of the term, and in fact, many celebrities over the years have essentially become idols, from Elvis Presley to the Beatles to who knows who else. Charlie Chaplin, is that going back far enough? But even when you watch the Academy Awards and you consider the world of movies and the heroes and the heroines and all the rest of it, it is apparent, if you look at the media, that idolatry indeed is alive and well in America and, in fact, in the world. You know, idols were very common in the ancient biblical world, and they were encountered by Israel at every turn as they occupied the Promised Land. It's interesting to note that there are essentially two commandments, two of the ten, that deal with that issue. Of course, the first and the second. The first says, you are to have no other gods before the true God. Paraphrasing, the second says, don't make any graven images. That is, for worship, essentially, God appears to be very concerned about how we approach Him and how we allow ourselves, perhaps, to bring other people or other objects in a position between ourselves and God. This afternoon, as we approach the Passover, I thought it might be interesting for us to explore the concept of idolatry in the context of the other gods that mankind has created down through the centuries, even up through today in the 21st century, where we're going to see that idolatry really reaches beyond stone and wooden images. First of all, let's take a look at an expanded definition of idolatry that I found in the Encyclopedia Britannica, no, in Wikipedia, the online encyclopedia. Notice what it says here regarding the definition of idolatry. Behavior considered idolatrous or potentially idolatrous may include the creation of any type of image of the deity, or of other figures of religious significance, such as prophets, saints, and clergy, the creation of images of any person or animal at all, and the use of religious symbols or secular ones. So it paints a rather broad definition of idolatry. In addition, theologians have extended the concept to include giving undue importance to aspects of religion other than God, or to non-religious aspects of life in general, with no involvement of images specifically. For instance, the Catechism of the Catholic Church states, quote, idolatry not only refers to false pagan worship, man commits idolatry whenever he honors and reveres a creature in place of God, whether this be gods or demons, for example, Satanism. Or it could be power, pleasure, race, ancestors, the state, money, you name it. There are a wide variety of elements in our lives that could actually become idols to us. Notice in 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy chapter 3. Timothy here list the characteristics of the times in which you and I are living, the perilous times that precede the return of Jesus Christ. He lists many of the characteristics that would be found, and many of them, of course, quite reminiscent of what Mr. Mitchell was talking about regarding the people of Sodom and their activities. But nonetheless, notice here in verse 5, it's sort of the bottom line of all of this. You read all of these unsavory forms of conduct, sinful forms of conduct. And notice the summary statement that Timothy gives here in verse 5. All of these individuals have a form of godliness, but deny its power. And you know how easily we can be drawn to people who appear to be godly. They have a form of godliness. They claim to be godly in their conduct. However, they deny the power of God. They deny the truth of God. They fail to humble themselves before the Almighty. And from such we are to turn away. So you notice here, we live in a culture, in a country that has many forms of godliness. I'll use a small g. But there is essentially a denial of God's power, His right, His ability, or His desire to intervene in the lives and the affairs of men. And as we see our nation embrace same-sex marriages, as we see the edict to fund through insurance all forms of abortion, termed incorrectly, I believe, contraceptives. All of these elements of our culture and society, you can see a steady degradation of the truth of God and the will of God, and yet there continues to be an aura of godliness about our nation. After all, on our currency, and among many of our leaders, there are comments about God and His mercy and His blessing upon our nation, which is indeed a fact, but nonetheless, do not be confused by the signals that are sent, both godly and ungodly, and assume that all is godly. There are those who have a form of godliness but deny its power. In general, mankind has tended to make or create gods in his image, that is, in man's image, rather than remake himself in the real image of God after the similitude of Jesus Christ. In other words, we would rather not obey the commandment of God regarding marriage. We would rather not embrace God's definition of marriage. We would rather make our own. And just as Eve succumbed to the temptation of Satan in the garden and said, you know, that's a tree that looks like it would make me smarter. Well, I've never looked at a tree that I thought would make me smarter. Maybe an apple a day keeps the doctor away. I don't know. But you see the deception that Eve encountered and embraced when Satan told her, look, God is lying to you. You're not going to die. So she took another look at the tree, and it looked better and better. Finally, she took the fruit. It didn't take long. And I want us to be aware of what true godliness is, and I want us to be aware of how susceptible you and I can be to this concept of idolatry. Because you and I don't have golden calves in our living rooms doesn't mean we aren't subject to being affected by idolatry. And we'll see that essentially in the broadest brush that I could use to describe what idolatry is, an idol is anything that comes between you and God. Anything. Anyone. And it's easy for that to happen in this life because Satan provides us with many distractions and many elements of human existence that could in fact do that. And we're going to examine those this afternoon. But before we get into the spiritual repercussions of idolatry, if you will, I wanted to take a look at some of the Old Testament history of idolatry and idols, particularly and specifically Israel's encounter with them, and God's advice to Israel and his frustration at Israel due to their failure to stay away from the idols and remove the idols and the high places. And I want to show that the attitude expressed in the Old Testament is one and the same that is expressed in the New Testament toward idolatry. Let's begin in 2 Chronicles chapter 15, where we pick up the story of Asa, king of Judah. 2 Chronicles chapter 15. Verse 16, he, that is Asa, is commended by God because in verse 16, he removed Maacah, the mother of Asa, the king, from being queen mother. So he removed his own mother because she had made an obscene image of Asherah, and Asa cut down her obscene image, crushed it, and burned it by the brook Kidron. So this action was applauded by God because that's exactly what he expected his leaders to do and all of Israel to do when they encountered idols. But the high places, verse 17, were not removed from Israel. Nevertheless, the heart of Asa was loyal all of his days. So Asa was willing to remove his own mother. He was willing to cut down the image, the obscene image of Asherah, and burn it. But he was not willing to get rid of the high places. And if you look historically at these high places, sadly, the nation of Israel and the nation of Judah, if you will, both tended to embrace the gods of the nations that they conquered. Both tended to look to groves and to high places, that is, elevated locations where they could worship these gods or place these images. In fact, sometimes they brought them into the tabernacle, into the temple. You read the history, as we all have been reading through our Bible reading program, and you find that it's a mixed bag with the kings of Israel and Judah. Some of them removed the idols but left the high places. Some did nothing. Some removed the high places and the idols. A variety of approaches. But God was always concerned about idolatry, and Israel embracing the gods of other nations. And we'll see why as we go through the accounts here. Now let's continue to look at Asa's example. In verse 7, you'll notice here that Asa had forged an alliance with the king of Syria, for he was going to fend off the king of Israel, who was Baasha, Baasha's attempt to invade Judah. So Baasha, the king of Israel, was preparing an invasion of Judah. It was brother against brother. A sad commentary on what religion can wind up doing, pitting brother against brother. It was never God's intention for the truth to separate. The truth was to unify. But sadly, our adversary and our own human nature are not in sync and in tune with God in that regard. So, as a result, a prophet comes to speak to Asa, king of Judah. He states in verse 7, "Because you have relied on the king of Syria, and have not relied on the Lord your God. Therefore, the army of the king of Syria has escaped from your hand." Now, notice what the prophet says. "Were the Ethiopians and the Lubim not a huge army with very many chariots and horsemen? Yet because you relied on the Lord, he delivered them into your hand." Now, what's the essence of God's beef against Asa? Well, as we read here, is it not clear that he trusted in an alliance with Syria instead of trusting in God? Do you think that's a form of idolatry? I think it is. Because here, Asa allowed his judgment to be blurred. He made a physical treaty with the king of Syria in order to protect his nation from an invasion from Israel. And as a result, God sent the prophet and condemned that action. So anything or anyone that comes between you and God can be considered an idol. And in this case, it was Asa's error and his placement of trust in the king of Syria, and he essentially avoided God. Now notice what Asa's reaction was here. Well, first, in verse 9, very important concept. The prophet continues, "For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is loyal to him." Whose heart is loyal to him. Do you think God is still walking to and fro on the earth looking for the same kind of people? I think he is. I know he is. And he's looking for people that are loyal to him. Not to some American idol or any other idol. People that are loyal to him and prove their loyalty by their actions, by their faith and belief in the true God and their refusal to let anyone or anything come between them and the true God. You shall have no other gods before me. That's a very strong statement, and God means what he says. So he's still looking for those kinds of people, and I hope all of us realize how important it is that we try to reflect that in our lives as being people who are totally committed and totally loyal to him. In this, the prophet tells Asa, "In this you have done foolishly. Therefore, from now on, you shall have wars." Then Asa was what? Angry with the seer. Well, the old messenger message comes to mind, doesn't it? He was angry with the messenger. How dare you speak to the king this way? Can't you just hear Asa exploding? Well, you know, I was just trying to protect. I was just doing this. I was just doing that. But really, Asa was wrong. He failed to show himself loyal to God. He not only got angry with the prophet, but later on he became diseased in his feet. And said disease became fatal. He did not seek the Lord when he was sick. So he was so angry and so upset that he turned his face away from God and would not seek him when he was sick, and refused to accept responsibility for allowing something or someone, Syria and his alliance with Syria, to come between himself and God. What a horrible death he died. What a painful death he died. What a sad commentary on someone who allowed idolatry to affect his life. And in a sense, once again, he allowed an idol to come between himself and God. He allowed another god, small g, to impact his life. And sometimes that other god, small g, is our own conscience. Sometimes it's our own human nature. Sometimes we listen to sources and we do things that we shouldn't do because we allow ourselves to be influenced by the world around us. And we convince ourselves that we're still being godly. But when you deny God's power to intervene and to lead and to direct and advise you, then you are in the same kind of danger that Asa was in. And Asa found himself incapable of admitting it and went to his death, convinced of his righteousness and undoubtedly angry at God because of God's failure to understand him and to accept what he did. Very sad commentary. But that's where this kind of thing can take you. Asa turned to Syria instead of God. We can define that broadly as idolatry. Now notice in chapter 17, here's Asa's son, Jehoshaphat. He becomes king of Judah. Now let's read just a little bit of what Jehoshaphat did. He placed troops in all the fortified cities of Judah, so he's still realizing a potential threat from enemies, probably Israel. He set garrisons in the land of Judah and the cities of Ephraim, which Asa his father had taken. Now the Lord was with Jehoshaphat. Why? Because he walked in the former ways of his father David and did not seek the Baals. He didn't seek after idols. So this, again, read the history as we have in our Bible reading program. Read through Kings and Chronicles and read the history of the kings of Israel and Judah. A very spotty record on the elimination of idols and high places. That's why Jehoshaphat received God's commendation. He did not seek the Baals. He sought the God of his father and walked in his commandments and not according to the acts of Israel. He was one of those that God is walking to and fro on the earth, looking for. God will show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is loyal to him, who will not let other gods get between them and the true God. Therefore, verse 5, the Lord established the kingdom in his hand, and all Judah gave presents to Jehoshaphat. And he had riches and honor in abundance, and his heart took delight in the ways of the Lord. Moreover, he removed the high places and wooden images from Judah, which his father failed to do. And also in the third year of his reign, he sent his leaders, Ben-Hail, Obadiah, Zechariah, Nathanael, and Micaiah, to teach the cities of Judah. In other words, he sent people out to teach the citizens of Judah, the people of Judah, from the book of the law, verse 9, they went throughout all the cities of Judah and taught the people. And the fear of the Lord fell on all the kingdoms of the lands that were around Judah, so that they did not make war against Jehoshaphat. He had peace. And to a large extent, it was the result of his attitude toward idols. He refused to let anything come between him and God. And he set about to teach all Judah about God's laws and his commandments. Notice in Deuteronomy chapter 6. You know, we've read this many, many times. And I think it's really interesting to note it in this context. Deuteronomy chapter 6. Instructions to the nation of Israel, explaining to them what God expected of them as he brought them into the land of promise, some warnings that he gave them, warnings, unfortunately, that they did not heed. Nonetheless, notice in verse 10, so it shall be when the Lord your God brings you into the land of which he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you large and beautiful cities which you did not build, houses full of all good things which you did not fill, hewn out wells which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant. Isn't it interesting that God brings out these points to Israel? When I bring you into this land, it's almost like that makeover show. You know, they completely transform this house, and the owners walk in and everybody's crying and the Kleenex are out and everybody's in. It's exciting. It's wonderful. I think it's a wonderful thing to see that happen. But the point is, it's really surprising to them. They had nothing to do with it. How appreciative are they? How thankful are they? Well, it's a marvelous thing to see a family transformed like that by someone who cared enough to do those things for them. And of course, there are many different groups and organizations that do things of a similar nature. But getting back to our account here, God points out that, look, first of all, let's go back to Israel and their captivity in Egypt. Who were they? They weren't even a nation. They were slaves. God made them a nation. He fulfilled his promise to Abraham. He gave them a leader. He drew them out of Egypt by miraculous events. The 10 plagues, the opening of the Red Sea. He fed them in the wilderness. He gave them shoes that didn't wear out, clothing that didn't wear out. All of the things he did for them. Finally, they got to the promised land. They walk into houses and vineyards and cities that they didn't even build. And when you add it all up, how grateful and thankful should they have been? And when you add it all up, how ungrateful, unthankful, and rebellious were they? And I think there is something for us to learn here as well in terms of our appreciation for what we have and what we have been given and essentially what we have inherited from previous generations. We are the beneficiaries of wonderful blessings, and the danger that is posed here to ancient Israel is alive and well for us today. Let's read it. When you have eaten and are full, the end of verse 11. When you are eaten and are full. Most of us in this room have never had a day in our lives when we either weren't full or couldn't have been full if we wanted to. In other words, most of us have been well fed all of our lives. That's why we're all trying to lose weight. Is there a problem with eating and being full? No, we're going to do it tonight. And you know what? We're going to go to bed tonight. We're going to get up and start it all over again. Nothing wrong with eating and being full. The only thing that can be wrong with eating and being full is if that sense of fullness makes us think that that fullness and all that made it possible came as the result of our mighty hand and our mighty works and our wonderful deeds and our wonderful nature. Verse 12. Then beware lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. Don't forget him. If you forget him, then you've allowed someone or something to come between you and God. You shall have no other gods before me. Don't forget me. Don't forget me. Don't forget who I am. Don't forget what I did for you. Don't forget who I am. No other gods. You shall fear, verse 13, the Lord your God, and serve him, and shall take oaths in his name. You shall not go after other gods. You shall not go after other gods. And I fear that sometimes we read this verse, and like I said, because we don't have a golden calf in our living room, we're not worried about it. Well, we should be concerned about it in the sense of what we're discussing this afternoon, relevant to anything or anyone that might come between us and the true God. It's a real danger. You shall not go after other gods, the gods of the peoples who are all around you. All around you. And we are surrounded, much like Lot, in Sodom and Gomorrah. Verse 15. Now here is a concept worth noting. For the Lord your God is a jealous God among you. And that, of course, is repeated in the giving of the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20 in their formal fashion. I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquities of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generations of those that hate me and showing mercy to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. He is a jealous God. Think marriage covenant. Think marriage. And you know, marriage is under assault as never before. And I'm afraid that as the world goes on, sometimes we're not as aware as we should be of the efforts of Satan to completely destroy that institution. Think jealous husband. The church is the bride of Christ. The father has taken Israel out of Egypt and made them His family. God the Father and Jesus Christ. God is a jealous God. From many different standpoints, we can understand it. But think of a faithful, devoted husband whose wife is unfaithful and not devoted. What is the reaction of the husband when he finds out? It's a terrible dilemma. It's a horrible malady. It happens, sadly, all too often. Now, in that context, if you think of God being a jealous God, when ancient Israel went after other idols, He was like a jealous husband. And when you and I allow other distractions and other elements of the life and the culture around us to so consume us that we don't have time for God, that we lose sight of His laws and commandments, that we compromise with what we should be doing, well, then we are in danger of committing spiritual idolatry, if you will. And we are giving allegiance to and responding to elements and situations that take us away from God, not toward Him. It's a real problem. For the Lord your God is a jealous God, and you are to stay away from the gods of the peoples who are all around you, lest the anger of the Lord your God be aroused against you and destroy you from the face of the earth. God desires your undivided worship, your praise, your honor, your respect. And as we discussed ancient Israel, none of us should ever forget how we came out of the bondage of sin. It wasn't by our intelligence or our choice necessarily. It was a divine calling empowered by the Spirit of God. So in that we share something with ancient Israel, don't we? In that we had nothing to do with it. It was God's doing. When you and I are blessed beyond measure, we could heed this warning as well. Do not forget your God, your Redeemer, your Creator, your Sustainer. For if you do, it's idolatrous. You've allowed something to come between you and God. I want you to notice in Deuteronomy chapter 13, the consequences meted out to those who would lure Israel away from the true God. This is how critically important this issue was to God. Notice the steps that He put in place and the commands that He issued in order to prevent this from happening. Verse 4 of Deuteronomy chapter 13. Speaking to Israel, you shall walk after the Lord your God and fear Him and keep His commandments and obey His voice. You shall serve Him and hold fast to Him. But that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death because he has spoken in order to turn you away from the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of bondage to entice you from the way in which the Lord your God commanded you to walk. So you shall put away the evil from your midst. God did not mince words. He did not take chances. Individuals who would tempt and draw away and lure them away from the true God were to be put to death. Whether they be prophets, whether they be dreamers, preachers, whatever. God had no tolerance, zero tolerance for this kind of activity. Verse 6, if your brother, the son of your mother, your son or your daughter, the wife of your bosom, or your friend who is your own soul secretly entices you, saying, let us go and serve other gods which you have not known, neither you nor your fathers. You have no connection with them, This is something new and tantalizing and different. What are you to say? You shall not consent to him or listen to him, nor shall your eye pity him, nor shall you spare him or conceal him. Remember, if it's your wife, your friend, your son, your mother, your brother, your daughter. Now, I'm illustrating here the intense importance and significance that God places on this concept of having no other gods before Him and not allowing anyone or anything to interfere with that relationship or draw you away from the truth of God in any fashion. That's why, consistent with the Old and New Testaments, we find God stating that if any brings out this doctrine, run the other way. Don't bid him into your house. It's very important that we read and heed these directives and not dismiss them, because they illustrate the God that is the same here, yesterday, today, and forever. That commandment still stands. You shall have no other gods before me. And in addition to that, I don't want you to make any image or idol or picture and worship it. Nothing of the kind. I am the God who brought you out. There is no other. And once we allow that image of God to be tainted, once we are drawn away to other gods, if you will, we are in all likelihood transgressing the commandments that we are talking about this afternoon. And again, death to those who would try to lure Israel away from the true God. Serious consequences. This is obviously important to God, and this concept should be important to us as well. Now in Exodus chapter 32, one more Old Testament reference here. Exodus 32. The issue of the golden calf. Now, it wasn't that long ago that Mount Sinai shook, that fire and lightning and brimstone and noise so frightened the children of Israel. They said, look, Moses, you talk to God. We can't bear this. And so they withdrew. Moses went up to the mountaintop, etc., etc. Now, when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, chapter 32 of Exodus, verse 1, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, come, make us gods that shall go before us. Wow. It didn't take long, did it? Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Aaron, could you make us some gods to go before us? For as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, the man who brought us here, we don't know what's happened to him. So you, Aaron, you make us gods. And sadly, Aaron said to them, break off the golden earrings which are in your ears. Bring all the gold to me. All the people brought their earrings and jewelry. He received gold. He fashioned it with an engraving tool. He made a molded calf. A molded calf. Then they said, the leaders of this rebellion said, this is your God, small g, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. Imagine it. It's almost laughable. But indeed, look what Israel did. Despite the powerful display of God's might and His majesty on Mount Sinai, in the space of 40 days, Israel despaired. They forgot God. They made a golden calf. Behold your God, O Israel. What an insult. What an insult. A terrible display on the part of Israel. And of course, what was Aaron's excuse when Moses confronted him when he came down the mount? Remember, he was angry and frustrated. Aaron said, I kind of put the gold in the fire and out popped this calf. It's these rebellious people that they wanted me to do this. Well, read the account. It doesn't sound like it happened that way. So how easily can we be distracted and drawn to someone or something that may come between us and the true God? Should we be alert to this? Look how quickly it happened to Israel and how completely they justified themselves. Turn with me to Matthew chapter 22. Matthew chapter 22. Let's begin here, verse 34. But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, that is Christ, it silenced them, they gathered together. So the Pharisees were going to take a run at him. One of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, as if he really wanted to know anything. He was trying to trip Christ up. It obviously couldn't be done. He said, "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?" And what follows is probably the quintessential description of the spirit of God's law. An outstanding summary of the spirit and intent of the laws and commandments of God. Notice verse 37. Jesus said to him in response, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind." Is there anything left? No, there shouldn't be. You love God with everything you have, and there is nothing left over for any other being, for any other object. Your love, your loyalty, your commitment, your desire to worship and honor and praise and glorify Him throughout your life is His totally and completely. Nothing can draw you away. And anyone or anything that tries to draw you away is met with the consequences that we read about in the Old Testament when there were people trying to draw Israel to their idols. So you see, in spirit, it is the same attitude here in the New Testament that we read about, described, and detailed in the book of Deuteronomy regarding the approach toward those who would lure you away from the true God. This is the first and great commandment. Now, the second is like it. So there's a first and great, and there's a second that's just like it. These two are important. It's essentially a summary of the laws and commandments of God. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. First four commandments, love toward God. Don't take God's name in vain. No idols. No other gods. Keep the Sabbath. Last six, love toward man. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And once again, what kind of indictment is that against the human race? If the highest degree of love we can express to our neighbor is the degree of love we express to ourselves, what does that tell you about human nature? It's something we've got to work a lifetime to overcome. It is on these two commandments that all the law and all the prophets are hung. The law and the prophets are hanging on these two commandments. They are that fundamental. And again, we're focusing on the first great commandment. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind or might or energy. God wants it all. Notice Luke chapter 14. This parable, I think, speaks to this concept. The parable of the Great Supper. And brethren, I think all of us, as we live in this age, in this time, the 21st century, it's amazing how time has gone on. It is amazing how the world keeps turning. And we see world events escalating in a way that I'm sure none of us have ever seen them escalate. We see prophetic indications in virtually everything that is happening, from Europe to the Middle East to our own nation. All over the world, the signs are clearly there. And in the context of this parable of the Great Supper, I think we would all do well to read and heed regarding how quickly physical things, physical attractions, our own carnal mind, which is enmity against God, can play into our lives and draw us away from God to the point where we would actually decline an invitation to the wedding supper. Read it. A certain man, verse 16, gave a great supper. He invited many. Now, I know the parable is basically referring to those who were invited, the Israelites, if you will. They rejected it, and so God opened the door to the Gentiles. It was always God's plan to do that. Let's set that aside for a moment. Certainly, that's a part of this parable. But let's talk about you and me, the here and now. You and I have an invitation to the Great Supper. What will you and I say when the word comes that we are to come to the supper, for all things are now ready? Finally, the day we've all been waiting for is here. And we're sitting here thinking, well, how could we possibly decline it? Well, how could these people possibly decline it? Come to my supper, all things are ready. Verse 18, but they all with one accord. Now, that's not the same as the publication I'm handing out. They all with one accord began to make excuse. The carnal mind, our own human nature, our heart that is deceitful and desperately wicked, it can twist and distort things, and unless we are keyed into God and connected to Him and have that same kind of attitude described in those verses in the Old Testament regarding anyone who would try to draw us away or anything, with all our heart, with all our mind, with all our soul and might and being, there is no other God. Listen, with all with one accord, they said, the first, I have purchased a piece of ground. I've got to go see it. Please excuse me. Now, we're sitting here saying there ain't no piece of ground worth that. May it always be so in our hearts and minds. What happened? Second, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen. I'm going to test them. Just bought a new Beamer. I want to go out and test it. I don't have time for the supper. You know, you've been telling me the time is ready for a long time. I've got other things. Other things that have come in to my life and drawn me away. Still another said, I've married a wife, and therefore I cannot go. Well, that sounds reasonable. I married a wife. I thought this was the wedding supper. I thought you were the bride of Christ. You've married a wife. Please have me excused. Well, they were all very polite, weren't they? Oh, I'm sorry. I send my regrets, RSVP. I can't make it. Verse 24. For I say to you that none of those men who were invited shall taste my supper. None of those men who made excuse, none of those men who allowed themselves to be drawn away will taste my supper. Something to think about, isn't it, as we approach the Passover, and now as we get into the remaining verses of this chapter, the famous, if you don't do these things, you can't be my disciples list. Counting the cost. And we all know these verses virtually by heart. We could probably recite them. Whoever doesn't give up father, mother, husband, wife, children, yes, his own life, he can't be my disciple. Why is that? Doesn't that seem harsh and stringent? Not if you believe in the first commandment, no other gods before me. You've got to be willing to give up everything, even your own life, or you can't be my disciple. You must bear your cross and follow me. You must count the cost. And don't start something you can't finish. You're like salt. But if you lose your savor, you're not good for anything. And idolatry can cause us to lose our savor. Now, let's notice in Galatians chapter 5, as we near our conclusion this afternoon, in Galatians 5, the list of the works of the flesh, verse 19. Now, the works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, idolatry. Idolatry. And as I said, because we don't have idols in our houses, are we then completely free of any concern regarding the impact of idolatry in our lives? I don't think so, and I hope I've made that point this afternoon. I hope that we all understand that idolatry can be both physical and spiritual in its application, and that anything we allow to come between ourselves and God or anyone can in fact become an idol. And it's something that we should be acutely aware of as we examine our lives and our conduct and attitude in approaching the Passover this year. Should we not consider these works of the flesh and their power to separate us from God as we prepare this year for the Passover? All of these things are potentially things that can take our attention, our worship, our life, our mind, our hearts, our energy, our spirit, away from God, who is jealous, who wants loyalty and devotion and commitment and dedication, who wants us to love Him with all of our heart, soul, mind, body, being, everything that we have. Pull it all out. Give it all to God. That's what He expects. That's, in essence, what the first commandment entails, having no other gods before me. That's His command, and certainly all of us clearly know that, and our application of that in our lives comes to our attention at least once a year as we consider the Passover and examine ourselves as we rightly should. So, as we conclude, clearly, idolatry reaches beyond graven images and high places. God desires our undivided worship, our praise, our reverence, and our respect. Now, before the Passover this year, I hope we will ask ourselves, who or what really comes first in our life? You know, all of us should ask that. For instance, what about prayer and Bible study? Are they priorities in your life, or there are other things, perhaps, that take priority in some cases? How do we spend our time? What are our hearts and spirits and attitudes like toward other people? How committed are we to God and His way of life? It's time for us to examine all of these things. Is there anything that we have allowed to come between ourselves and God? What a wonderful opportunity for us to call upon God's Spirit to help us examine our lives as we approach the Passover. And at the same time, allow us to put the words of God into our lives, into our hearts, and our minds as we do prepare. So let's listen to these words. Let them impact upon us as never before. For God Himself says, "You shall have no other gods before me."